This is a University of Otago podcast.
Good evening. My name is Harlene Hain, and I have the great privilege of being the Vice Chancellor here at the University of Otago. Now, those of you who've been reading the ODT over the last few days know that I've been spending a bit of time with different stakeholders around the university. And I must say that I'm very happy that that little weekend is over, and we can now have an interaction with a different kind of stakeholder. And it's fantastic to see members of a variety of different academic divisions here at the University of Otago, as well as members of the general public. And we're all here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to celebrate the amazing academic success of one of our newly anointed professors, Professor Michael Albert. This is always a fantastic opportunity for members of the university community to just pause during their busy day and to spend a little bit of time educating themselves through the brilliance of the people who take the time and the effort to work here at the University of Otago. Those of you who are regular attendees at these events will know that I often say that it is very difficult to be promoted to the position of professor here at the University of Otago. We have extraordinarily exacting standards, and we exercise them religiously. So to be promoted from within this institution is truly a cause for celebration. So I am so glad to see you here to celebrate with us for this amazing academic achievement. I will now call on the Pro Vice Chancellor of Sciences, Professor Keith Hunter, to give us a brief introduction to our speaker this evening.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor, and good evening, everybody. Once again, it's my pleasure to introduce a new inaugural professorial lecture. Before I do that, since this is a science lecture and it has something to do with probability, I guess, I'd like to conduct a simple poll. Could all those people in the audience who are left-handed put their hands up, or ambidextrous? Great. The significance of this will become clear. So our speaker today, Michael Albert, was born in Peterborough, Ontario, in Canada, and he attended the University of Waterloo and did a double major in pure and applied mathematics. He tells me without ever having taken a course on differential equations, and I find that very hard to believe, but obviously it's true. It's not too late. He was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship and studied under Hilary Priestley at Oxford for his PhD in the field of category theory, which he says he promptly abandoned after he graduated. He then had a postdoc at Waterloo for a few years, working in logic and algebra, and then had a brief period, or not a brief period, quite a number of years in the mathematics department at Carnegie Mellon University, but then came to New Zealand largely for family reasons. And shortly after he arrived, he was employed as a senior teaching fellow in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics here at Otago. And in 2000, he was applied for and was appointed lecturer in computer science. And he has, of course, risen through the ranks to recently being promoted to professor. And congratulations on that, Michael. He describes himself as a bit of a jack of all trades, working in a number of areas of mathematics, excluding, of course, differential equations. Now, those of you who attend these meetings regularly know that I like to finish with a funny anecdote about the speaker, and I ask them to provide the anecdote, and if I don't like it, I make one up. So here's Michael's anecdote. He lived in Germany for 2 years as a child when his father was teaching at a Canadian Armed Forces base. And at the time, he attended a local kindergarten that was run by sisters of a religious order. And when it became apparent that he was fairly determinedly left-handed, the sisters felt the need to have a meeting with his parents, and they kindly pointed out to his parents that it was no longer a social stigma to be left-handed. But they shouldn't have any great expectations about intellectual or sporting achievements on his part. So I think you can safely say there's a sufficient nucleus of left-handers in this audience to show that that theory is completely incorrect. So, Michael, once again, congratulations on your promotion to professor, and I invite you to present your inaugural professorial lecture.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor. Thank you, Keith. So to continue with the thanks before I get started properly, I'd like to thank all my colleagues in the Department of Computer Science who've made it so easy for me to advance through the ranks here and provide a really supportive environment and a great place to work. And of course, I'd also like to thank all the people I've collaborated with over the years. Almost all of my papers are co-authored with often multiple co-authors, but at least one. And without the aid and assistance of those co-authors, I certainly wouldn't have been able to do the things I've done. And finally, I'd like to thank a person who belongs to the intersection of those two classes, Mike Atkinson, more particularly, first of all, for encouraging me via my ex-wife to apply for the position in the computer science department, which I might not have thought of on my own, and secondly, for introducing me to the subject about which I'm going to talk broadly today. And at the same time, I need to apologize to him for taking certain liberties with it as we go through the talk today. Right, so again, before I start properly, I want to repeat a well-understood anecdote that I've heard many times that says a good lecture contains, well, hold on a moment, it's actually not that. It's a good mathematical lecture contains. And now I have to make a confession as well, that although I've been appointed a professor in the Department of Computer Science, if you passed my CV off to a reviewer, double blind, redacting my name and all my job affiliations and so on and so forth, and asked what academic discipline does this person work in, I suspect quite strongly that the answer would be mathematics. So the work I've been doing in recent years with Mike and other people is in the area of discrete mathematics. It's certainly applicable in parts of computer science and draws some of its inspiration from computer science, but it's still largely mathematical work. Now, what a good mathematical lecture is supposed to contain is one joke, one proof, and no formulas. So I'll try to stay true to at least two of those three ingredients in the talk today. I think it says something about the sort of academic mind or the academic profession that I spent some little amount of time trying to find an attribution for this, because I've certainly heard it many, many times, many, many places. I thought it must be due to Hardy or Littlewood or some famous mathematician, but no, it just seems to be quite literally folklore. It's something you'll hear and unfortunately not see carried out often enough. Right, so the talk today is about shuffling, but more particularly or more generally about rearrangement of things, because after all, that's all that shuffling is. Shuffling is just a matter of rearranging a deck of cards we normally think of when we talk about shuffling. And rearrangement comes in a number of different flavors. Probably the most important of them for computer science is sorting. All right. Donald Knuth's Art of Computer Programming, the Bible of Computer Science, one entire volume of three, originally now four, is devoted to sorting and searching. Sorting is critical because sorting enables search. All right, if you had to find someone, if you have a telephone book and you need to find someone's telephone number and you know their surname, you can find it quickly because the numbers are ordered by surname and you can search within that list. If there were no ordering by surname of the telephone numbers, if they were, say, ordered by telephone number or not at all, it would be rather difficult to search within that list. So sorting is still critical to computer science. In fact, we devote six lectures of our second year papers to sorting. I have to say, there isn't some data center somewhere that contains a sorted copy of the internet. That's not what happens when you do a Google search. It's not that, you know, the whole contents of the internet have been sorted and it can then go and carefully look it up. There's rather more going on there. There's some rather clever stuff going on with indexing. And more generally, there's a lot of stuff going on with organization and categorization. So that's another way in which you reorganize things. You know, put things in files according to their types, possibly have links to other things of the same type or related types, and generally organize things that way. And finally, of course, we come to shuffling, which is basically the exact opposite of those first two types. The purpose of sorting, the purpose of organization or categorization is to expose structure or create structure in a collection of data or a collection of objects. The purpose of shuffling is to destroy it, to completely disorganize the things that you're working with. Apparently, I'm quite good at this. Sharon's laughing there. My partner Sharon will tell you quite in great detail. I seem to be capable of disorganizing the contents of a cutlery drawer or a linen cupboard without even thinking about it. So it's probably appropriate that I'm talking about shuffling. Now, I see some of my second year students here. I invited them to come along because in last week's lecture in 241, I explained how easy it was to shuffle well. Okay? Shuffling well is really, really straightforward. You don't need to be clever. You don't need to do anything clever. You just need an effective source of randomness. Okay? If you can mix things up, not know where the cards will fall, and then pick them up again, you have a well-shuffled collection of cards. All right, but mathematicians, unless they're statisticians or probabilists, aren't terribly fond of randomness in general. Okay? And the types of shuffling I want to talk about today are shuffles that are not really quite so random. And I want to introduce one of them by means of a little card trick. So, Vice Chancellor, could you pick a card, please? I'm going to turn away because they're not as opaque as they might be. Can you show it to the audience? Thank you. All right, put it back face down on top of the deck. Thank you. You haven't had anything to do yet. Can you just cut the deck once, please? Okay. And so, of course, the goal of this card trick, as with every card trick, is to reveal the card I'm not supposed to know about. I don't think that's it. I don't think that's it. Don't think that's it. I think that's it. All right. So what's going on there? Well, what's going on there is that a cut is not a very good way to shuffle a deck of cards. Well, that's pretty obvious anyway. But I want to illustrate this in a bit more detail to sort of work into the subject as a whole. So doing math, we have to have graphs. So here's our first graph. This is a deck of cards before I've done anything to it. The cards have a certain position at the start, and for obscure reasons, it's going to be useful to think about starting at the bottom. So think about the left-hand position on the horizontal or x-axis as the bottom card, worked up to the right to the top card. So bottom to the top along the horizontal axis, and bottom to top along the vertical axis. And if I don't do anything to the deck, the graph of where the cards live looks like this graph. Every card is in its home position. Okay? Now, I'm not making any claim about the identity of the cards. I'm not saying it's the ace of spades, then the two of spades, and the three of spades. They could be any cards at all. I don't care what the cards are. I only care about where they are. So if I start with a deck in any order whatsoever, and I don't do anything to it, this is the picture of the way the cards are organized. Now, okay, it should be lots of little dots instead of one big line because the cards are discrete objects, but, you know, it all looks the same. So imagine there's lots of little dots. So how does a cut work? Well, first you pick a place in the deck, right? So that's marked by the horizontal line. That cuts the bottom half, this part to the left and below the horizontal line, away from the top half. And then you move everything that was on the bottom to the top. Now, if we sort of think of that as floating, we can illustrate what goes on. Okay, the top part of the deck is effectively dropping down. The bottom part of the deck is moving up. Okay, I love computers. Why is the label on the y-axis now fin, which fortunately is French for finish instead of finish? It's because if I tried to make the label on the y-axis finish, the slide insisted on turning around into landscape mode. So we'll stick with it like this. Okay, so the effect of a single cut is to rearrange the cards in this way. So remember, the horizontal position still identifies the place the cards were at the beginning. The vertical position represents their new place. So the top card which is the at the beginning was right at the end of the deck, is now somewhere in the middle. Okay, the first card is a card from somewhere in the middle of the deck. Now, even if we cut the deck twice, and I didn't do that for reasons of time, but we do another cut of the same type, we wind up with the same pattern. That is, we get a sequence of cards which are still in their original order, followed by another sequence of cards still in their original order, basically a top half and a bottom half of the deck. No matter how many times you cut a deck of cards, you get no more shuffling effect than if you'd cut it once. And that's the secret of the trick. Because, of course, the point is to try and figure out, I had the card put back on the top of the deck, what card this card is. That's the original, that's its original start position, okay? And the point is that after the cut, it will follow the card that was at the end of the deck. So I peeked, I knew what the card was on the bottom of the deck, I only had to look for that, and then the very next card was the card that had been picked out. I know you're not supposed to give tricks away, but I've never understood that. I think the whole point is to understand how the trick was done, so anyway. Okay, so cutting isn't a very good way to shuffle cards. Now let me just pick out a few cards that we can recognize in order, because I want to talk about which arrangements we can produce by cuts rather than which arrangements we can't produce by cuts. And of course, the cards you want are never near the top of the deck, but we'll carry on. The problem I want to talk about in general is what is a shuffle? Okay, so for the purposes of my lecture today, a shuffle, or I actually want to think about this as a shuffle type, if you like, or a shuffle family, because I don't want to think about one particular shuffle. I want to think about a number of different ways, but related, of accomplishing a shuffle. So a cut is both a particular cut that you might make, but if I have a deck of, let's say, six cards, that's all I'll work with for now, then there are six different ways, or possibly seven, just depending on how you decide to count, there are six different ways to cut it. Now, just for convenience, I've now organized them so it goes ace through six, bottom to top, so things are in order. So what are the different ways to cut it? Well, there's always a top pile or a bottom pile. Okay? Maybe there's nothing at all in the top pile. That's not a very interesting cut. Okay? But there it is. Maybe there's one card in the top pile. That's one possible cut of a deck of six cards. Or two cards, or three cards, or four cards, or five cards, or all six cards. So there are basically seven different cuts. Two of them produce the same arrangement of cards. If I cut with nothing on top or cut with nothing on the bottom, they don't do anything. They produce the same arrangement of cards. So we get six different arrangements by cutting a six-card deck. So shuffle is a description, like I've just given, of a method for producing some rearrangements of a set of cards. Now, that phrase has far too many vague words in it for a mathematician. Okay, description, method, cards. So let me try and be a little bit more precise, or deal with this in a way that's fairly common in mathematics, which is, if you want to get away from the mechanism by which things are produced, you focus just on the outcomes instead of the way the outcomes are created. So instead of thinking about the mechanism by which a deck of cards is cut, I just want to think about the different possible outcomes. And those outcomes are what I'll call the cut, or the cut family, or the cut type for that particular deck of cards. And of course, the key point is that the cards, there could be any number of cards in the deck. Now we have the opposite problem. If I take that second point as defining what a shuffle is, it's just a set of rearrangements, then I have far too much flexibility. I can do anything at all. I can write down any set of rearrangements and say, well, that's a shuffle. So I want to add one additional and critical condition, and that's this. Whoops. If I take the deck and add an extra card or two or five or 17 or 200, I rearrange it according to some legal mechanism, and then I take away all the cards that I added, and I look only at the rearrangement I got with my original cards, that should still be a legal rearrangement of the deck. So that's the point. If I take a few extra cards and stuff them in the deck willy-nilly, make sure they're not small values, okay, took a few extra cards, cut somewhere, then I go and take the extra cards out again, the jack, the queen, and the king, right? The resulting cards, this is the part of the talk I could never get right. The resulting cards are still in an ordinary cut order. There's the six followed by the ace through five. So the extra cards don't help me. They could get in the way effectively in some types of cut, in some types of shuffles, but they never actually help me. So for us, a shuffle is going to be one of these possible ways of rearranging cards that has this property that extra cards can't help. All right. So here's the thing. I have six cards in the deck. I already mentioned there's only six ways to produce cuts of those six cards, or six different rearrangements I get by cutting those six cards. There are 720 possible rearrangements of the cards. If I give you an arrangement of the cards, how can you tell that it's one of the 714 bad ones and not one of the six good ones? Okay, well, one way, because we know what the cuts look like, is to start looking at the beginning and just keep going till you find a problem. Now, the thing with that is that I might go 6, 1, 2, 3, 5, 4, and I know there's a problem. But I didn't know that there was a problem until I was at the very, very end of looking through the deck of cards. Because up to that point, everything seemed to be going fine. But hang on a moment. Did I really need all those cards? What if I just looked at the 1, 5, and the 4? That's not, if my original deck was 1, 4, 5, that's not a legal cut either. And by that rule, that says those three cards alone in that order in the deck, not necessarily consecutive cards anymore, but three cards in that order in the deck, are already enough to prove to me that the deck as a whole wasn't produced by a cut. Okay? So what we're talking about here is that, just like I've been doing with the ace through six, we're numbering the cards according to their original position in the deck, since we don't actually care what the specific cards are. And I had another realization about the sort of mathematical mind when I was talking about this with someone else today. When a mathematician says, it doesn't matter what the names are, what that means is, I'm going to give them names to make my life convenient. But what a non-mathematician hears is, oh, I don't need to pay attention to the names. Anyhow, if we only have a one-card deck, how can we cut it? Well, not really at all, but there aren't any rearrangements to produce, so we produce all the possible arrangements of a one-card deck. If we have a two-card deck, where'd my two go? If we have a two-card deck, I can either cut across the top or across the bottom, leaving them in the original order, or I can cut through the middle, which reverses the order. So with a two-card deck, I get two possible shuffles with a cut, namely 1-2 and 2-1. And that's all the possible arrangements of two things. We can see how this is going. With three cards, I can get 1-2-3, or if I start with two, it has to go 2-3-1, or if I start with three, it has to go 3-1-2. If I start with four cards, I can start with 1, 2, 3, or 4, and I just always count up until I reach the top, and then I go back to the bottom and count up again. All right, and so on. All right, and there's four different cuts if I have four cards, 5 if I have 5, 6 if I have 6. So I want to focus now on the three arrangements of three cards that we don't see there. And that is 1, 3, 2. If we start with 1, we can't have the 3 next. 2, 1, 3, if we start with 2, we can't have the 1 next, or 3, 2, 1. Going back to our graphs, what I'm saying is that if I have a graph that looks like generically the graph on the left, which describes sort of a general type of cut of an initial deck, it can't contain any picture that looks like the three pictures on the right. can't contain a 3-2-1 because, okay, to go down, you have to go from the top branch to the second branch to the bottom branch, and then there's nothing below that. And you can just check each of the other conditions doesn't sit in there either. All right, so now comes the proof. Not the proof of this, that's supposed to be clear. That's just all about cuts. The proof is the proof that goes in the other direction, which is about recognizing when something isn't a cut. So I claim that to show you that something isn't a cut, I can always do it by finding three elements in one of those three orders. So what I need to convince you is that if I don't contain three elements in one of those three orders, then I do have a cut. Okay. The place I want to start is the bottom of the deck. All right. There is some card on the bottom of the deck. That's that red dot that I've drawn there. You can't argue with me about that. Okay. There will be a card on the bottom of the deck. All right. Now I want to look at the three patterns in turn. And I'm going to start with the 2-1-3 pattern. Okay, it's called 2-1-3 because that's the rearrangement we've done. If I don't see that pattern, I claim that the rest of the cards have to be in the white areas somehow. Because what can't happen is that I have a card before. Where'd the poker go? I can't have a card that comes before this one that lies below a card that comes after this one. All the cards that come before have to lie above all the cards that come later. So there's some sort of forbidden areas. Everything before is above everything that comes later. All right, that's that pattern done with. We can get rid of it. Now let's look at the 1-3-2 pattern. Concentrate again. Remember that last card is there. Look. After that last card and above it, I'm never allowed to go down. So everything after that last card and above it has to come in increasing order. So to the right of that, I have a nice long rise without any drops. Okay, that's the second pattern. And of course, the top corner is going to come from the third pattern, the 3-2-1. Again, I have that one point down at the bottom there. And the 3-2-1 pattern says that above it and to its left, I'm not allowed to have any drops. So above it and to its left, everything has to be in increasing order as well. So if I don't see any of those three patterns, then the overall picture has to be like that, and that's exactly what we know that a cut looks like. So we've proved a theorem. Okay? A rearrangement is a cut shuffle if and only if, famous mathematical phrase, it does not contain any one of the patterns 1-3-2, 2-1-3, or 3-2-1. Okay. So we have a way of identifying, if I give you a big rearranged list and you know what the original ordering is, you only need to show me three elements to prove to me that it's not produced by a cut. Because if it's not produced by a cut, you will be able to find three elements in one of those three patterns. Okay, so let's recap the story so far. A shuffle is just a set of possible rearrangements of cards with, or anything really, doesn't have to be cards, with this extra little condition that says we can't do more stuff by adding extra cards. And it follows, and I don't want to go into the details, it's not critical, but we can actually characterize, just as we've done in this case, every shuffle of this type by a certain set of basic forbidden patterns. So in the cut shuffle, we had those three forbidden patterns, 1-3-2, 2-1-3, and 3-2-1. Every shuffle can be characterized in exactly that way. If you don't see any one of these patterns, then you're a good shuffle. If you do see one of these patterns, you're a bad shuffle. Okay, so repeating myself, if one of those patterns occurs in a rearrangement, it can't be produced by the shuffle, but if not, it can. Okay, and so a good shuffle, something which we can produce by the shuffle, is one that has none of these forbidden patterns. Okay? Sorry. A good shuffle is one where there's no forbidden patterns, where anything goes. Okay? That's the collection of all rearrangements. That's what we would hope to be able to get when we shuffle a deck of cards effectively, okay, by throwing them up in the air and then gathering them up, or by whatever means. Not all shuffles are good, though. we've just seen the cut is a particularly bad sort of shuffle. Whoops, wrong pocket. But even the most common shuffle that you'll see, or the most common, well, maybe not the most common, second most common, which is the riffle shuffle, is also not a good shuffle. Okay? Certainly not if I just do it once. Why not? Well, because I still have two halves of the deck. I'm now linking them together, all right. I'm interleaving them in a much more complex way than I might have done with just a cut. But at the very least, I still can't see a 3-2-1 pattern. I can't completely reverse the order of three elements with one riffle shuffle, because half the deck stays in order, the other half of the deck stays in order. Two of the three elements in that three-element set are from one half of the deck, and so they're still in order. We haven't had them completely reversed. Okay. If we have a bad shuffle, how good can it be? All right, maybe, you know, I can probably understand that one riffle shuffle isn't very good, but, you know, maybe if I riffle shuffle 10 times, it doesn't matter how big my deck of cards is, I could produce any rearrangement that I like. Well, probably not any rearrangement, because there's still going to be things about reversing long lists that I can't do, okay? Okay, so yeah, there's going to be a bit of stuff you can't do, but you know, 90% of the arrangements you could produce, or something like that, surely. Okay? So here's the question. How good can a bad shuffle be? And now we come to the slide where the no formulas rule is a bit tricky. So a central conjecture in this area of mathematics, which was posed sometime in the 1980s, and no one can be sure exactly when, because it was just sort of floating in the air. Everyone knew that it was due to Stanley and Wilf, but no one could pin down the conference at which it was first mentioned. And so it didn't start appearing until it started appearing in papers 5 years later. And everyone then already knew it was a big problem. So the best we can do is associate the names with it. And in loose terms, the Stanley-Wilf conjecture says that every bad shuffle is very bad indeed, no matter how long the shortest forbidden pattern is. Okay. I can tell you, if I have a shuffle which can produce every shuffle of a deck up to 100 cards, but there's one shuffle of 101 cards it can't do. That seems pretty good. I mean, it's certainly perfect for if I'm dealing with a normal 52-card deck. Okay. But the fact is, once the deck gets sufficiently big, there's going to be a vanishingly small proportion of the rearrangements that I can actually reproduce. Almost every rearrangement will contain that forbidden pattern. The conjecture is actually somewhat stronger than that even, but that's enough for getting on with. So like I said, this was posed sometime in the early 1980s. It was actually open for about 25 years, late 70s, early 80s. It was resolved by two very young mathematicians at the time, Adam Marcus, who was an American, Gábor Tardos, who's a Hungarian. Adam was in Budapest at the time on an exchange program as an undergraduate at whatever the famous mathematical institute in Budapest is. And it's a gorgeous proof. It's a truly elegant and beautiful proof. And it's about 2.5 pages long. And if you've got decent background in combinatorics, you can actually explain it to someone in about half an hour. And it's kind of embarrassing that it took 25 years to find. But of course, maybe it's not embarrassing, because it, as is all too common in this sort of a situation, the proof was actually by looking at a different problem, a related problem, but a completely different problem, and using a very clever argument, a very clever non-constructive argument that happened to have the Stanley-Wilf conjecture come out as a corollary. One of the problems with the proof is it doesn't actually tell us much about shuffles. It doesn't give us much information about how good or how bad shuffles are. It just says the ones that aren't good are bad. Okay? In particular, associated with every shuffle, there's a certain numerical parameter, which I could call its growth rate. Okay? Now, for good shuffling, which means I can do anything, that parameter is infinity. The cut shuffle is about as bad as it can get. The cut shuffle is, that parameter is 1. OK? Okay? And basically, the Stanley-Wilf conjecture, or now theorem, Marcus Tarter's theorem, says that that parameter is finite for every bad shuffle. So the difference between bad shuffles and good shuffles is not the difference between 10 and 1,000 or 10 and 1,000,000. It's the difference between 10 and infinity. Okay? And that's a pretty big difference indeed. Now, I mentioned the Riffle shuffle. Okay? The basic Riffle shuffle has a growth rate of 2. Okay, and there's quite a lot known about the Riffle shuffle, actually. This was a subject of a detailed investigation by Percy Diaconis, who is a probabilist and a statistician, and David Aldous. And they were interested in the actual more practical question. How many Riffle shuffles of an ordinary deck of cards is good enough? Okay. Now, of course, to do that, you need some sort of probabilistic model about what people actually do when they do Riffle shuffles. Okay, a clever magician, very few mathematicians, but lots of magicians, can do a perfect Riffle shuffle. They can split the deck into two halves of 26 cards and exactly interlace them, time after time after time. And there's a clever trick associated with this as well, which is that if you do the so-called out shuffle, where the top card stays on the top and the bottom card stays on the bottom perfectly, you only need to do it 8 times before you get the original order of the deck back. Okay. So you can stand there, shuffle away, you know, start with a brand new deck, and everyone can see, you know, all the suits in order and so on. Shuffle it 8 times, nothing's happened. Okay. But of course, when people actually do shuffle, you know, sometimes 2 cards drop, sometimes 3 cards drop, et cetera, et cetera. The halves aren't exactly the same, and so on and so forth. So Diaconis and Aldous modeled that. And then they said, well, okay, we know that we're not going to get everything. So what we're actually going to look is we're going to look at the statistics, various statistics associated with the deck. And the sorts of statistics we're interested in are things like, we're about to play a game of bridge, a game I know a little bit about, okay? If we deal this deck out to 4 people, on average, or more or less, are they getting hands that look like 13 random cards from the deck, no matter what we started with? And the conclusion of that work is that basically, to be reasonably confident, if you're a decent shuffler, but not too good, okay, 7 or 8 or possibly 6 Riffle shuffles is adequate for randomizing the deck for almost any card game that you'd care to play. For some card games, if suit doesn't matter, for example, if you're playing blackjack, then 4 or 5 is enough. But in general, 7 or 8 to be safe. There's another common shuffle that people do, which is the overhand shuffle, which I don't do perfectly well, but something like that. Okay, the overhand shuffle is not that different from a cut. It's better than a cut. You can eventually produce every rearrangement. If I think of this as one overhand shuffle, you can eventually produce every rearrangement. But in order to get something like as good a distribution as you'd get with 7 or 8 Riffle shuffles, you need to do a couple of 1,000 overhand shuffles. So don't trust people who shuffle overhand all the time. Okay, so moving from the practical to the more abstract again, if we look at the shuffles where we just say, I'm going to forbid a certain pattern of length 3, a single pattern of length 3, like 3-2-1. I'll allow 1-3-2 and 2-1-3 again, but I'm still going to forbid 3-2-1. It turns out that for those shuffles, the growth rate is always 4. So we're getting better. Okay, there was a conjecture that came around not too long after the Stanley-Wilf conjecture, which had to deal with the specific case where we forbid a certain single pattern of length 4. And the conjecture here was that that growth rate was always at most 9. There was a pattern of length 4, namely 4-3-2-1, for which it was known to be 9. There were some other patterns for which the growth rate was known. And there were sort of plausible arguments why 9 should be an upper bound here. But good things about conjectures is sometimes they're true and sometimes they're false. This one turns out to be false. If we forbid the pattern 4-2-3-1, so we never see a pattern like the red dots on the bottom there, then the growth rate is at least 9.47. Okay, now why haven't I told you the growth rate? Well, because I don't actually know the growth rate, but I do know that it's at least 9.47. Because the way we proved this was not to look at this shuffle at all, but to look at a sequence of smaller shuffles, that got closer and closer towards the shuffle, and we looked at their growth rates. And so since this produces more shuffles, its growth rate has to be bigger. Okay, and the last shuffle we were able to deal with gave us this growth rate of 9.47. And why was it the last shuffle we were able to deal with? Well, in order to work out the growth rate of that shuffle, what we had was a network, abstract network, with about 25 million nodes and edges between quite a lot of them. And the number of shuffles of length 17, say, that avoided, that were in the smaller class, was the same as the number of paths of length 17 in this network. Okay. So we had to be able to count the paths in this, we had to count the paths in this network. Okay, now it's various technicalities. You don't actually need to count paths, you write down a big matrix and you do some clever stuff and you work out the so-called dominant eigenvalue, and that actually gives you the growth rate. So why did we stop there? Because you know this was just one, this was about the 14th approximation. Well, the problem is that each time we went one degree further up in the approximation, the number of nodes in this network goes up by a factor of about 6. So next time it was 150 million nodes, and then 900 million nodes, and so on and so forth. Obviously, we're not working this out with pencil and paper, but even on a computer, it was reaching the point where it just really wasn't, the game wasn't worth the candle anymore. So in principle, we could sneak up closer and closer to the growth rate. We don't actually know that we'd get to the growth rate, but in practice, it's not really a feasible mechanism. But what we're trying to do here is work out ways of sort of getting around this issue, if you like, with the Marcus Tardish proof of not having a handle on growth rates, not having a handle, if you like, on the actual structure of the shuffle class. And so we're looking for various restrictions and various conditions under which we can say, for shuffles of a particular type, we could, if sufficiently bored, compute the growth rate. Okay? And we're not actually that much interested in the growth rate. We're only interested in establishing that we could figure it out if we really wanted to. Okay? That's a sort of what I'd call a structural proof. We're showing that the shuffle class is nice enough that if we had the incentive, we could work out the growth rate. Okay, let me talk about a particular shuffle that's kind of fun. It's not a very good shuffle. We're going to deal cards one or two at a time. Okay, and if I'm dealing two cards, I can reverse their order. So it's easy to draw this shuffle in a sort of picture now. Instead of using the graph we were using before, think of the top row as being the original order of the cards, and the next row is now a shuffled order. Okay, so some cards got dealt one at a time and just got dropped down, and in other cases we had pairs of cards that were being reversed. Okay, if I look at that shuffle and I start counting how many different shuffles there are for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cards and so on, I get 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, et cetera, different shuffles. Now that's a very famous sequence in mathematics, goes back at least to the 13th century. It's called the Fibonacci sequence. Each number in the sequence is the sum of the preceding two. Okay. And that's a growth rate of 1.6 something odd. Okay. It turns out that for this particular case, there are again exactly three basic forbidden shuffles of length 3. They're just a different set of three shuffles, 2-3-1, 3-1-2, and 3-2-1. And we could work out why that is. Those are basically the things of length 3 where something's moved two places. Okay? Because the key point is if we do the shuffle once, we can only move something by one position, by an exchange. So if anything moves two places, we're dead. As opposed to the cut shuffle, with this shuffle, we can actually produce any rearrangements of the cards by doing it often enough and carefully enough. So that's something. Okay? But if we limit to a fixed number of applications, let's say 17, then there are always some forbidden patterns. It's always a bad shuffle. So in order to get a good shuffle, we have to allow arbitrarily many applications. But again, if sufficiently bored, we could work out what it is that happens in those cases. One of the interesting things, and one of the things that is why I say this is an amusing shuffle, is that this is where something occurs which we haven't seen before, which is I've been talking about these basic forbidden patterns, and I think I've sort of created an assumption that the basic forbidden patterns is just a sort of finite list all the time. It turns out that even if I just look at five shuffles of this type, I can't write down a finite list of basic forbidden patterns. And the reason is something like this picture. What does that mean? There's lots of lines missing here. So all the missing lines should go bottom to top vertically if they can, and cross over otherwise, right? So otherwise, if I put all those in, the picture would get too cluttered. I'm trying to create the rearrangement with five shuffles that I see at the bottom. So in particular, the first card is supposed to be moving to the sixth place, so it has to be switched every time. Now, this card is trying to move back four places, so it gets switched four times and stays in one place once. For that to happen, you can check that it has to stay in one place here. If it tries to stay in one place at any of the previous steps, it'll be trying to cross through this location in the last step. All right? So that has to go in that pattern. And then we weave that together in that same idea, all these ones which are trying to move four places. They're being woven together so that if they're going to work, they have to work in exactly this way. And then we break the whole thing at the very end by saying, aha, no, the last card wants to come all the way in five places. And it can't. It has to cross here. So whatever this rearrangement is, we can't produce it with five shuffles because of this crossing. But, and this is where you'll just have to accept my word on faith, if I erase any dot in the top line and the corresponding points thereafter, I create just enough extra flexibility that I can now do the rearrangement. So this is a forbidden pattern, but it doesn't contain any shorter forbidden pattern. If I take one card out of the deck, any one card, I can do it with five shuffles, but I can't do the deck as a whole. And the thing is, I can link together as many of these crossings as I like, so I can't get a finite list of basic forbidden patterns. They get longer and longer. There's structure to them. I can describe them, but there's not a finite set of them. Okay, just almost wrapping up here, I want to talk about something which is almost an application of this material. Okay, let's talk about a supercut. In a supercut, I divide the deck into four pieces. Okay, and then I switch the two middle pieces. And then I put the deck back together again. So basically, it's like a cut where I only cut the part in the middle of the deck, and I keep some cards at the top and some cards at the bottom fixed. Okay. Those are sometimes called block transpositions, okay? And the block transposition shuffle is another one of these ones that if you do it often enough, you can do anything. Basically, because you can exchange any two cards, keep everything but two cards fixed and exchange those two, that's always enough to make sure you can do anything. If you can do that, you can always do anything. Okay, so we can produce any rearrangement with block transpositions. Okay, this has been considered as a very, very simplified model for some forms of genomic mutation and evolution. Okay, I want to emphasize here, this is an ultra-simplified and abstracted model. It has next to nothing to do with the way the biochemistry actually works. Okay, confusingly, in that area, these are just called transpositions, which means something completely different to a mathematician, but never mind. Okay, so in that context, the question you're interested in is you've got one, let's say, genome. You've got another genome, which is a rearrangement of the first one. Question is, how close together are they? How few transpositions can you do to get from one to the other? You know you can always do it, but you want to do it as efficiently as possible. Okay? That's slightly different from the things we've been talking about, but again, if you asked me, can I do it in five moves, I could answer that. I'd say, let me do some preliminary computation, and having done that preliminary computation, any question you ask me about five moves, I can answer very fast. Okay? Oh, you want to know about 10 moves? Okay. Give me a day. Do my preliminary computation. Now, any question you ask me about 10 moves, I can do very fast. Okay? But now you say, well, that's not really the question I want to know. I want to know how many moves does it take. And the problem is I can't go away and say, I can tell you very fast, because as of last year, this problem was shown to be NP-hard. Which basically means that it's very unlikely that there's a fast algorithm for solving this distance problem. You'd be very rich if you found one, let's just say. Win at least $1 million prize, get along speaking tours, and so on. Okay, so just to wrap things up, I've tried to draw in a certain amount of new material and of some of the things that I've worked with, but the overriding goal for me in the research that we've been carrying out about these areas is to try to understand the structure that exists within bad shuffles. One of the long-term goals, which is not perhaps it's still quite a ways away in the distant horizon, is to perhaps find some sort of an internal proof of the Stanley-Wolf conjecture that tells us really why this is true about shuffles rather than being a consequence of some other structure we don't understand. There are general grounds to know that it's impossible to describe structure in all shuffles, but that's not a contraindication to the first goal, because to prove Stanley-Wolf, all I need to show is that for every shuffle, there's a better shuffle that has structure. If I can prove that every shuffle with structure has a growth rate, and for every shuffle, there's a better shuffle with structure, even if this shuffle doesn't have structure, it still has a growth rate because it sits below a shuffle with a growth rate. And we've had some success in that area. I mean, we do know that all shuffles whose growth rate is sufficiently small, less than about 2.3, and many other related ones of the same type, can be described in this sort of structural fashion. Now, that 2.3 boundary is actually a natural boundary. There's something fundamental going on there. That's exactly the point at which these shuffles that don't have structure appear. Okay. So the current attack is to try and force this through to perhaps higher growth rates. The next aim, I think, is to get up to 4, basically, and we kind of have a plan for doing that by adding some just mild additional assumptions. Okay, and to return just for the moment, for the last moment, to computer science, I do have to say that one of the great advantages of being allowed to sit and work on the computer and not feel like I'm cheating has been that a lot of software has been developed that supports this endeavor. When you shuffle 8 cards, there are 40,000 different ways that you can rearrange them. When you shuffle 10 cards, there are 3.6 million. Okay. When you shuffle 12 cards, there are whatever it is, several hundred million. Okay. It's all too easy when you're working by hand to write down a conjecture, which you can check for, 4 or 5. But by hand, even if you're very systematic and can prune out huge amounts of the trees from the forest, you really can't do much. My experience is you can't get much past 7 or 8 when you're trying to check things by hand. Okay. Software helps a bit. We still have this horrible combinatorial explosion that the number of shuffles grows so fast that it gets out of control no matter what you do. But somehow it's much more comforting to know this works up to length 14 than it is to know that this works up to length 6. And then in some cases, the pruning is effective enough that you can say, no, actually, it works up to length 30, or it works up to length 40, or something like that. And then you get really confident in the result. And my experience has been there's nothing more helpful in actually finding a proof than being confident that the result you're trying to prove is actually true. So thank you. That's all for those who are interested. Here's a few acknowledgments and references. Thank you very much.
Vice Chancellor, Pro-Vice Chancellors, my colleague Michael, ladies and gentlemen, and friends. When a mathematician stands in front of an audience and tries to give them some impression about what he's doing, he faces a difficult task. Had I been trying to do that, I think I would have vanished into the floor in fright. But Michael has given us an impression about the sort of work that he has been doing over the years. The examples that he's chosen have all been couched in the language of shuffling. And as he indicated, this does betray an interest of his, which is bridge playing. And I might just say as a personal aside here, I've been fortunate to be a bridge partner of his. It's been an immense pleasure. But a greater pleasure has been to be his colleague over the last 12 years and to watch him become more and more expert and more of a leader in the international community. Michael has not, through modesty, said very much about his place in the community of people who study shuffles, or permutations, as we call them, in the community. But he's a leader in three senses. First of all, he's written papers, some of which he has given us a hint about tonight, which have shown the way for other researchers to come in his wake and produce spin-off results with. The second way he's been a leader is as a mentor for many young researchers in the international community. I've seen him many times at conferences talking to young people who have a problem with their research, come to Michael for guidance. He's a very approachable person, and almost always he gives them lots of his time. And the end result of that is not a joint paper very often. It's an acknowledgement in a young researcher's work that Professor Michael Albert has given him significant help through a difficult patch. And the third way in which he's been the leader of the community is he's now the chief organizer of the main conference in the subject, which steers the way for the community to advance year on year. He chairs the steering committee, and I'd like you to imagine, if you can, what it's like to have a committee of mathematicians. They're all sort of like this. And what you need in such a community is somebody who has got some personality, some presence, who will lead them in the right direction. Michael has begun to do that, and over the next few years, I expect to see tremendous results from his work in that direction. So tonight, we've seen an expert who has shown us from a bird's eye view some of the complex questions that arise in arrangements of objects. We thank you, Michael, for helping us through the minefield of those difficulties so expertly. And it's my pleasure to present to you on behalf of the university this gift of our appreciation and to wish you well in the rest of your career and at Otago.